is to blow holes in the earth, maybe cave in some tunnels and get the beasts to show themselves. But that was his frustration speaking, and it could end up killing Dohai and any other prisoners below ground. Slow and steady saves lives, Fitz thought. They approached the crest of another rolling hill, far past the outskirts of Outpost Turkey River's safe zone. Every step they took was another pulling them deeper into enemy territory. Ace froze, his eyes on the screen. He motioned to Fitz to join him. If Fitz wasn't mistaken, the strange deep blue and black colors appearing in a semicircle on the screen were what the engineers had told them they would see if they had indeed found a tunnel. Fitz studied the image for a second, making sure what he was seeing was real. Lieutenant Scott chimed back in over the channel.
Ghost One, Overwatch One, you have a positive read. Tunnel depth approximately 1 meter down and 3 meters in diameter directly below your position. Appears to lead 20 degrees east from current course.
Fitz signaled to Mendez to adjust his route and follow Scott's directions. Sure enough, the signal on Ace's radar screen remained strong. Fitz followed, finally confident that they had a trail of some kind. They still didn't know if this was the tunnel that Dohai had gone down, but without any other leads, this was the best chance they had of finding some clue as to where their brother had gone. Ace stopped again, and Fitz checked the screen. Strange shapes emerged there. Green, globular things, almost like spirits. There were variants under their feet, and possibly human prisoners too.
Ghost One, slow down, Scott said over the comm channel. Any idea how many targets are down there? Fitz asked.
There was a slight pause before the lieutenant replied.
Ghost One, by my estimate, you've got 6 to 8 contacts.
Fitz did the math. Getting the scoop on 6 to 8 variants would be tough, but doable. Especially if a couple of those contacts turned out to be captive humans and not variants.
Ghost One, Scott began. I'm seeing something strange. Is there any issue with the R2TD system? Like one of the power supply cords damaged or something?
Fitz and Ace gave the cables and system a cursory glance, but neither of them was as technically familiar with the system as the engineers.
Negative, Fitz responded. At least as far as I can tell.
Yeah, I'm getting some really weird readings, Scott replied.
Fitz looked at the screen. A flash of white seemed to illuminate the circumference of the tunnel on the radar readings.
Is it this halo-looking thing you're talking about?
Correct, Ghost One, Scott said. If you're seeing it too, that means it's not just an imaging artifact on my end.
Fitz wasn't sure what the engineer meant by artifact, but he didn't like the sudden nervousness in the man's voice. Fitz peered back over his shoulder. The woods around them were mostly silent, not even the call of the crows that lived in the canopy. Only a few dried leaves brushing against each other.
The electromagnetic induction system that the R2TD uses can also detect other EM signals, Scott said.
In English, please, Fitz said.
Electrical wires, communications equipment, all that stuff. If there's power going through a cable, for instance, it'll give off a signal like that.
And light up the whole tunnel?
Negative, Scott said.
Ghost One, something's happening below you. The entire tunnel is exploding in electromagnetic activity, like the whole thing is wired or something.
Fitz racked his mind, trying to come up with any explanation that made sense.
That webbing, Rico whispered.
You think? She had no time to finish the thought. A huge, green, amorphous shape appeared on Ace's screen. Fitz saw it only for a brief second before the ground erupted, soil and grass flying around them. The force of the blast sent Ace flying backward. He hit a tree trunk, his helmet cracking against the side and knocking him unconscious. Fitz managed to level his rifle up as the cloud of dirt fell back to the ground. A beast appeared at the lip of the hole and jumped out, blood seeping out of the dirt-covered flesh. The monster looked like some muscular mix of a bat and a gorilla. Long fibrous growths stood out of its spine like a porcupine's quills. It let out a series of shrieking clicks, bulbous head swiveling on its neck.
Take it down, Fitz ordered.
The rest of Team Ghost fired as he pulled the trigger. The beast propelled itself through the torrent of gunfire, barreling straight toward Ace, who was still limp on the ground. Rico tried to move in closer, chewing up the creature's flank, Lincoln and Mendez followed suit, battering at the creature with gunfire. The beast started to slow, wounds stitching its side. A long groan erupted from its wormy lips as it reared back a meaty fist tipped with knife-like claws.
"Behind us!" Rico shouted.
Fitz twisted as six grunt variants emerged from the hole. He didn't even need to yell at Mendez and Rico to turn their focus on the beasts. Fitz finished his magazine, scoring several more hits on the Alpha.
"Help!" Rico shouted.
Lincoln turned to provide covering fire while Fitz changed his magazine. In the seconds it took him to pull out a fresh one and palm it home, the Alpha had reached Ace. More blood sprayed from the rounds buried in its flesh, and yet the creature still advanced, bending down with a talon-tipped claw. But to Fitz's surprise, the blades didn't curl around the fallen member of Team Ghost. Instead, they grabbed the long tubular portion of the R2TD. The beast crunched into the metal, and the device fell apart like it was nothing more than a Lego model. For a moment, the creature stood there. It let out a breath, almost as if it was relieved, blood trickling out of its gaping nostrils and weeping down the front of its chest. Then it collapsed, the ground trembling from the impact. Fitz checked his six, seeing the other members of Ghost had cleared the area. Crumpled variants lay in the dirt. Rico and Mendez stepped between the fresh corpses of the smaller variants, while Lincoln followed Fitz over to the beast. Another transmission hissed over the comm channel, and he could finally make out the lieutenant.
"I lost the signal," Scott said.
Fitz kicked the dirt near the shattered machine and reported the loss. Then he made his way over to Ace, who began to stir, lifting a hand toward his head.
"You good?" Rico said.
Ace managed a nod.
"You sure?" Fitz said, crouching. "I've taken worse hits in my day, boss," Ace said, as Fitz and Mendez helped him to his feet. "So, what do we do now that we don't have R2-DT to guide us?" Lincoln said.
Fitz found himself missing Apollo right now more than ever. The team could use the dog's nose, and he considered requesting the army send fresh canine reinforcements to help their search. But even if they did, that would just take up more time that they might not have to find Dohai. Fitz walked over to the Alpha and nudged the enormous clawed hand. The beast didn't move. Blood seeped from its body, soaking the ground. He stared at it for a moment, wondering what had compelled it to go straight for the radar system, as if it possessed some kind of preternatural intelligence.
"You hear that?" Mendez whispered.
The scratching came a moment later, and Fitz nodded. He ordered Rico and Lincoln to watch over Ace, then gestured for Mendez to fall in with him. They moved around the side of the Alpha, guns pointed at the hole in the ground where the Alpha and its minions had appeared. A dark shape moved out of the dirt there. Soil-covered fingers clawed at the lip of the hole, pulling a body up covered in mud. Nothing but the white of the creature's eyes showed.
"Hold your fire,"
the creature said in an all-too-familiar voice. Fitz lowered his rifle and blinked to make sure his eyes weren't playing tricks on him.
"Dohai," Rico said.
She bent down, and together with Fitz they grabbed Dohai and helped pull him onto solid ground.
"Dude, where the—" Lincoln said.
He and Mendez looked down the hole, aiming their rifles into the darkness. Dohai sat up on his knees and wiped his face with a sleeve. As much as Fitz was thrilled to see his friend, Dohai smelled like he had just crawled out of a sewer.
"Water,"
Dohai choked. Fitz quickly handed him a water bottle. The rest of the team were all grins, but they didn't give away their position by calling out in celebration. Dohai finished off a drink, wiped his mouth, and then looked at the Alpha.
"That monster almost ended me," he said.
"What the hell is it?" Fitz said.
"Some new kind of Alpha," Dohai said.
Ace staggered over like he was drunk, with blood dripping down his forehead. He cradled his shotgun and stood over the hole, guarding it with the others while Fitz opened a channel to command.
"Hotspot One, this is Ghost One requesting evac. We've got a brand new specimen for you. Copy that, Ghost. Send in a chopper to the outpost. Over."
"We got a haul ass back there,"
Lincoln muttered when Fitz shared the news. "Who's got the rope?" Rico asked. Lincoln looked at her and then the Alpha.
"You gotta be kidding me. We're taking it with?"
he grumbled.
"Yeah, and you're gonna pull it first," Fitz said.
Mendez chuckled.
You're such a baby, brah.
You help him.
Fitz watched as the grin on Mendez's face soured. Working with Lincoln, he helped secure the rope around the alpha's legs.
Damn, look at these paws, Lincoln said. Huge.
All the better for digging by the looks of it, Mendez said.
Let's move out, Fitz said.
He led Team Ghost off in silence toward the evac zone back in the walled-off outpost. It was slow going, and the team took turns dragging the monster that was basically a tunnel-digging machine.
Fitz held his questions for Dohai, trying to keep quiet, and also give the man some time to collect his thoughts.
Glad to have you back, brother, Fitz said.
Dohai hardly reacted, his eyes glazed like he was in a trance. An hour and a half later, the distant thump of a bird sounded. Lincoln and Mendez dragged the Alpha out toward the landing zone, while the rest of the team scanned the shadows for hostiles. If the variants were going to attack, this would be the time. But the beasts remained hidden, and the choppers set down, the crew hopping out to help load the Alpha. The crew chief passed a new headset to Dohai. After Dohai drank another bottle of water, Fitz finally figured it was time to ask him some questions, the most obvious one coming first.
How'd you find us? Fitz said. I followed the gunfire and the screams.
Fitz was so tired he hadn't even considered it. Of course Dohai would have come toward the sound of gunfire. But why had the Alpha come after the R2TD? That was a question far above his pay grade. But looking at the beast slumped on the floor of the chopper, he imagined someone would be able to figure it out. For now, Fitz was counting his blessings. They had Dohai back, and they had killed a beast that might just hold the key to the mystery behind the tunnels and recent attacks. Today was a victory. He would savor it as long as he could.
12. I've got to figure out what's going on, Beckham said to Kate.
I understand why you have to go, Kate said. Hopefully President Ringgold will be able to give you answers.
He had expected Kate to protest, but if the bags under her eyes were any indication, she was too exhausted. Voices outside brought him to the window of the historic brick and stone hotel that was now serving as a shelter for the survivors of Peaks Island. The room his family had been assigned was small but nice, with two bedrooms, a large bathroom, and a kitchen. It wasn't their comfortable home back on Peaks Island, but it would suffice until they could return. Outside, a platoon of Marines patrolled the streets. They had deployed all across the country at affected outposts per President Ringgold's orders. Beckham felt much better about leaving now that they were here, especially since Kate also had Sergeant Ruckley and her ranger team assigned to protect the lab. Kate pinched the bridge of her nose.
Eric, he asked.
Kate nodded and sighed.
Tired.
Beckham was too, but at least he could sleep on the ride to command.
You promise you'll try and get some sleep now? He asked her.
She placed a hand on her forehead.
If I can, but not until tonight. I've got to get back to the lab. I just wanted to see you off and make sure Javier and the kids are okay.
Beckham hated seeing her like this, but she had duties to their country just like he did, and she took them just as seriously.
Has that sample that Fitz sent back been helpful? Beckham asked, anxious to hear about it.
Helpful is a generous word. I've only had the day to analyze it, but so far I've got more questions than answers.
Do you at least have some idea what the stuff is?
Kate pulled her hand away from her head.
This is going to sound crazy, but it looks to me like mammalian muscle and nerve cells. They seem to spontaneously grow at an alarming rate, faster than even cancer cells.
Beckham knew just enough about science to know that was weird.
I didn't think cells like that could just grow outside an animal's body.
Normally they can't, Kate said. There are a whole bunch of reasons why they shouldn't be able to grow like they are. Most obvious is the lack of nutrient and oxygen delivery, along with a working immune system.
So you're telling me those tunnel walls are alive?
He thought she was going to shrug, but after a slight hesitation, she nodded.
Not literally, she said. The cells are, those vines are, but not the tunnels. Still, the longer I examined the cells under the scope, the more red and white blood cells I found. There seemed to be small vesicles, too, to deliver those cells.
She stepped closer to the window.
Whatever this growth is, it's unlike anything I've seen before.
This has to have something to do with Outpost Turkey River, don't you think? The missing people?
Probably. My guess is the variants are using people as food and energy, like fodder for the cellular growths. Hard to tell right now, though.
Beckham swallowed hard at the implications.
With the sheer number of nerve cells in there, I'd have to guess it's some kind of massive sensory organ or something, Kate said. How exactly it works, or why, I'm still not sure, but that's what I hope to find out. Only way to do that is to go back to the lab.
She gave Beckham a hug, holding him tightly for a moment.
It feels good to have some work to do, she admitted with her head to his chest. Spending time in the lab has made me miss Ellis even more, though. He was a close friend, no denying that. But I could also use a hand or two on these experiments. It's a lot for one person to do.
I'd be surprised if Ringgold doesn't already have plans to send help your way. If she doesn't, I'll request it.
I wouldn't say no to that.
She pulled away and took in a deep breath.
I just hope whatever is happening, we can stop it.
Dohai is alive, and the Alpha the team killed might help us figure out what's going on. Everything is going to be okay.
Maybe for us, but not for everyone. Not for Timothy.
Beckham brooded at her words. She was right. Timothy's life would be forever changed. We'll take care of him, he said. Kate simply nodded.
We survived the war, Beckham said. We'll survive whatever this is.
Whatever this is, he thought. The limited intel he had right now wasn't much, but it led him to believe that the attacks at the outposts were the start of something much bigger and widely coordinated. That's exactly why President Ringgold had requested his council at command to meet her and Team Ghost. But it wasn't just soldiers that would win this new fight. The work Kate was doing in her lab was also important. The thump of a chopper sounded in the distance, and a Blackhawk crossed over the city, putting down in a green space a few blocks away.
My ride is here, he said. I better get moving so I can say goodbye to Javier and the kids.
He walked away from the window to grab his rucksack and rifle, but she grabbed his prosthetic hand.
Reed, we still haven't talked about Senator McComb, Kate said.
I know, but that can wait. For now, the more important thing is figuring out who is behind these attacks and what those tunnels are used for.
But what if President Ringgold asks you to run for Senate again? With McComb gone, she'll be even more desperate to find a good candidate.
I won't make a decision without talking to you first, I promise.
He threw his pack over his shoulders and slung his rifle. Then he opened the door and reached for her hand. She gripped his prosthetic on the walk to the stairs. Several doors were open along the way, one of them to the room Donna was sharing with her son. Beckham paused at the open doorway.
You guys doing okay?
Donna managed a half-smile, but he knew it was forced. She limped over to the door, her ankle wrapped. Beau wore a tank top that showed off his muscular body. He seemed fine, despite the bandage on his head. The two had been through so much in the past decade. Once again, they were victims of war. And if it weren't for Beckham and Horn, they would have ended up like Beau's father, Red. A memory of the large man fighting the bone collector on Plum Island flashed through Beckham's memory. The same beast that had killed Staff Sergeant Alex the Kid Riley.
Your ankle okay? Beckham asked Donna.
She directed her dull eyes at him and nodded. All of the torment she had suffered had taken its toll. Beckham wasn't sure if Donna would ever come back from the darkness, but he believed there was still hope for her son. Beau still had a sparkle in his gaze. Like most kids, he was resilient.
I heard that Raider died in the police station.
Beau crossed his arms as he continued.
You should have let me take care of that piece of garbage in the woods.
The spark Beckham had seen a few moments before seemed to grow, but instead of the optimism and hope Beckham had expected, it was replaced by rage.
We needed information from him, Beckham said.
Did you get any? Beau asked.
Beckham shook his head.
Unfortunately, no.
Beau snorted and muttered under his breath.
I've got to go, but I'll see you both soon, Beckham said. He nodded at Donna and then did the same to Bo. The teenager nodded back and walked away, fists still clenched, knuckles white. Just wanted to make sure you were doing all right.
Let me know if you need anything, Kate said. I'm right down the hall.
Thank you, Donna replied. She slowly shut the door, whispering something to Bo that Beckham couldn't make out. Kate frowned and Beckham let out a sigh. They made their way down the stairs to the lobby. The place was packed with their fellow refugees, all friends and neighbors from Peaks Island. Beckham said hello to a few people but hurried outside. Horn stood on the sidewalk smoking a cigarette, a rifle slung over his back.
Where are the kids? Kate asked, holding up a hand to shield her tired eyes from the sun.
Horn pointed with his cigarette at the park across the street.
Figured I'd let him run a bit.
Laughter came from behind several trees in the park. The sound was the last thing Beckham had expected to hear, but it was a welcome one. He followed the drifting giggles to the park with Kate and Horn. On the other side of the trees, they found Javier, Tasha, and Jenny playing with Ginger and Spark. The dogs rolled in the grass and chased a bone Javier threw. But not everyone was enjoying the sunshine and dogs. Timothy sat on a bench, staring into the distance.
Better keep a close eye on him while I'm gone, Beckham said.
Kate folded her arms across her chest, looking at the young man with concern.
I will. He's staying at the shelter until things are secure on the island, and then we'll have to figure out if he's going to stay with us.
Like I said, we'll take care of him, Beckham said.
Horn flicked his cigarette on the ground.
He's welcome to stay with me, too.
We'll figure it all out. Beckham shrugged his pack higher on his shoulder.
I've really got to get to the bird now. How long are you going to be gone?
Horn asked. Hopefully not more than a day or two. Horn smothered the cigarette with a boot.
You sure you don't want me to come?
I want you to stay here and keep watch over the home fires, Beckham said.
You got it, boss.
Javier spotted them then and came running over. He wrapped his arms around Beckham.
Look after your mom for me while I'm gone.
I will, Dad.
Javier ran back to the other kids, and Beckham made his way over to Timothy. The teenager looked up as he approached.
How you doing? Beckham asked.
Timothy didn't reply.
I'm really sorry about your dad.
Timothy didn't respond to that either, but he did look at Beckham's fatigues, rucksack, and weapon.
You going somewhere?
Beckham pointed to the chopper waiting in a field a few blocks away.
To SOCOM on the USS George Johnson.
Can I come?
You have a more important role here, Beckham said.
He jerked his chin at the kids.
I need you to look after everyone like your dad did.
Timothy glanced around.
I want to fight, not play babysitter.
Beckham understood where he was coming from. Just like Bo, Timothy wanted to fight back, wanted revenge for what he'd lost. But neither of the boys were ready or even trained to fight the raiders or variants.
When I get back, you, me, and Bo are going to sit down to talk about your futures, Beckham said. Until then, please watch after things here for me, okay?
Yeah, okay, Timothy replied.
He got up and followed Beckham over to the group that had huddled around the dogs.
I'll see you all soon, Beckham said.
He finished his goodbyes, patted Spark and Ginger, and then he set off for a new mission. The pilots and crew chief waited for him in the grass outside the Black Hawk, eating a snack of local produce a few citizens had brought them.
Captain Beckham, good to have you with us, said one of the pilots.
He climbed back into the cockpit and the crew chief jumped into the open troop hold.
Captain, he said, handing him a headset.
Thanks, Beckham said.
A few minutes later, they pulled into the air. Beckham looked out the window to the quaint city below, seeing the hotel turned shelter for refugees from Peak Island and the Marines and Rangers patrolling the area. Several Humvees and a MAT-V sat parked in front of the police station. Despite all their firepower and armor, they hadn't been able to stop the raider from burning his face off with variant acid. Debris piles and the charcoaled ground outside Town Hall evinced the night's destruction. Beckham closed his eyes and rested his head on the bulkhead. There were so many questions in his mind. Hopefully, in a few hours, he would start to get some answers. But first, he needed sleep. President Jan Ringgold flew under the cover of darkness in a stealth Black Hawk, like the one she had used to escape the attack on the Greenbrier almost 8 years ago. Tonight, she wasn't escaping anything, but her nerves were still tight like back then. Over the past several days, the situation had escalated from one outpost going dark to three outposts going dark, and three more attacked by raiders. Her generals and intelligence officers were still piecing things together. By the time she reached command, she hoped to have a better idea of what the hell was happening out there. She had been in politics long enough to know one thing. These attacks would have a dramatic effect on the upcoming election. The violence gave General Cornelius and his Freedom Party plenty of ammo to accuse her administration of being unable to protect the country, which meant more ammo to support bombing the cities and conscripting an army of kids to fight. Last week, Vice President Lemke had been ahead in the polls. This week, the polls would tell a different story. Fear was a powerful motivating factor, and there had been plenty of reasons for fear to spread through the citizens of the safe zones. She opened her briefing folder to see more numbers. These were in polls. They were the number of troops she had at her disposal. Before she left, she had requested the current count from her staff. Now she stared at them. These can't be right. 12,000 and change wasn't much. There were 98 outposts, varying in size. If her math was right, and she deployed all the troops equally, there would be just over 120 for each outpost to join the current militias there. Hardly an army. The Navy and Air Force had about the same numbers combined, with just shy of 15,000. But that wouldn't help at the outposts, except by pulling the special ops teams like the SEALs. She didn't like it, but Cornelius had 2,000 of his own men and women in his private army that could be deployed should the need arise. But she wasn't sure how cooperative he would be given the current political climate, and certainly didn't want to rely on them if she didn't have to. Next, she looked at the current estimate of variants in the frontier and living in the abandoned cities. The number seemed like a lot, but it wasn't a surprise. 60,000 to 65,000. The estimate had actually gone down since she saw it last, with scientists arguing the creatures were starving to death and killing each other. There was almost no evidence of any breeding, which was another good sign that their numbers would continue to drop. The beasts didn't seem like a huge threat until now, and that's why she hadn't destroyed the cities or sent in precious troops to wipe them out. Plus, there was still the hope that someday humanity could reclaim those urban centers, once symbols of their economic and cultural strength. The idea was to let the creatures die naturally and only go after the alphas that ventured out to cause problems at the outposts. The plan had worked well, until 2 days ago.
ETA 15 minutes, Madam President, said one of the pilots.
Ringgold put her briefing folder back into her pack, trying to suppress her worries. She was packing light, expecting to stay on the USS George Johnson only 24 hours or less. Vice President Lemke had remained behind at the Greenbriars PEOC. He and Brigadier General Lucas Barnes had insisted she stay there, but she wanted to talk in person to the teams most familiar with the situation. The soldiers on the ground were always more knowledgeable than the generals about what was really happening from her experience. Men like Captain Reed Beckham, whom she trusted more than all of her generals combined. He had served his country in a way few men in the history of the country had served, and now she needed him for a new mission. With the death of Senator McComb last night, it was time for the former leader of Team Ghost to carry the torch into the halls of Congress. She also needed his wife Kate to figure out what was going on in the tunnels. The couple had done more for America than anyone she knew, and once again she was asking for their help.
"Prepare for landing," said one of the pilots.
Ringgold looked out the porthole window. She knew she was over the ocean, but she couldn't see the stealth destroyer in the darkness. Clouds drifted across the horizon, blocking out most of the moonlight and the stars. A few moments later, the wheels touched down with a soft jolt. The crew chief across from her opened the door, and two of her Secret Service agents helped her onto the deck. A group of Marines ran over to escort them. General Noah Souza, the SOCOM commander, waited for her outside a hatch. He was a handsome man with a square jaw, sharp nose, and even sharper green eyes.
"Madam President, good to have you with us tonight,"
he said in his rough voice. "Thank you, General. First things first, take me to that Alpha." Souza looked at her security guards, but quickly focused back on her.
"Yes, Madam President. But I'll warn you, it's pretty gruesome."
"I've seen plenty of dead monsters," she said.
"That makes two of us," Souza said. "Follow me, Madam President."
They went to the lower decks where two Marines stood guard outside a hatch marked with a biohazard symbol. When they saw her, both men came to attention. "At ease, gentlemen," she said. Souza gestured toward the hatch and the Marines opened it to a cold, dark room. One of them switched on a light, revealing several metal tables. A corpse lay on the center table, covered mostly by a white blanket. Huge arms hung over the sides, talons protruding out of thick fingers. Footsteps echoed down the passage, and a man wearing a white lab coat with slicked black hair joined them.
"Madam President, I'd like to introduce you to Dr. Jeff Carr," said Souza.
Ringgold shook the man's hand. "Nice to meet you, President Ringgold," Carr said. "I take it you want to see our new specimen."
"Indeed I do."
Souza nodded at the two Marines. They entered the freezing room, and Carr followed without hesitation. He pulled reading glasses out of his breast pocket, put them on, and then placed a pair of protective goggles over those. "Let's give President Ringgold a look at our new friend," Carr said. The Marines pulled the blanket back to reveal the grotesque ape-like face of a monster without eyes. Crusted blood lined its wide nostrils, and saggy lips hung over curved fangs. But it was the bat-like ears fanning off its face that sparked her curiosity. She stepped closer.
"Doctor, tell me what in the devil I'm looking at."
"A new alpha variant, Madam President." Ringgold kept her gaze on the beast while Carr put on surgical gloves. Then he grabbed a scalpel off a tray and used it to push up a flap of skin covering a tendril on its back. "This alpha has strange attributes unlike any I've seen, and I've seen a lot," he said, glancing up for a moment. "The huge claw's purpose seems clear enough. Digging." He focused back on the tendril. "But these are more interesting. They have some kind of fibers in them. According to Team Ghost, those fibers seem to interact with the webs in all those tunnels. I'm told Dr. Kate Lovato is working on identifying and studying those samples."
"She is," Souza confirmed.
"I'd like to talk to her," Carr said. "Get her opinion on what we're dealing with."
"And what's yours?" Ringgold asked.
Carr looked down at the corpse for several moments before glancing at her.
"I think we're dealing with a deadly new threat that's been evolving underground right beneath our noses."
XIII
"Beckham!" shouted Rico.
She got up from the metal table and ran across the mess hall of the USS George Johnson. Fitz pushed himself up fast, a bit too fast. Pain flashed across his back, reminding him of the injuries and damage his body had never quite had the chance to recover from. The soreness quickly faded, replaced by joy at the sight of his friend and mentor. He and the rest of Team Ghost followed quickly after Rico toward his old friend, anxious to talk to the man that had once been the leader of the Delta Force Team Ghost. Beckham walked toward them with a slight limp on his way to embrace Rico. Despite the limp and the prosthetic hand, Beckham looked pretty good to Fitz, if not a bit older. His perpetual 5 o'clock shadow had streaks of gray on his chin, and his hair was much longer, but his uniform was filled out well with hardened muscles.
"Captain, it's great to see you," Fitz said.
He reached out to shake Beckham's hand, but Beckham wrapped him up in a hug like he had Rico.
"You know you're not supposed to call me Captain," he said. "I'm a civilian now." "You'll always be the leader of Team Ghost to me," Fitz smiled, and patted Beckham on the back. "I've missed you, my friend. I've missed you too, brother."
They pulled away, and Beckham looked Fitz up and down.
"You look good," he said. "Still got that baby face."
Fitz stroked his chin and smirked.
"Still can't grow a beard, but Rico doesn't seem to mind."
"Not a fan of facial hair on myself, or others,"
Rico said with a grin. That got a laugh from the rest of them.
No offense, of course, Captain.
None taken. Kate doesn't seem to mind.
How is Kate and the rest of the family? Rico asked. And Big Horn and his girls?
The family is okay. So is Horn and his family. But we lost Jake Temper and 22 more people across Peaks Island and Portland in the attack.
The grins on Team Ghost's faces all vanished. Fitz said a mental prayer for Jake and the other victims, then quickly regained his composure. Now was not the time to grieve. Now was the time to prevent this from happening to anyone else.
The Raiders bombed Portland, too, Beckham added. Senator McComb was one of the victims.
Fitz reached back up and stroked his chin nervously this time. Not only had they lost one of the best men Fitz had ever known, but they had lost a senator aligned with the New America Coalition agenda.
I can't believe it, Rico said, shaking her pink streaked hair.
How in the hell did they get past the defenses?
Lincoln asked. I suspect they had an inside source. They posed as civilians and drove right through gates and pickups, Beckham replied. Another group took a boat to Peaks Island.
And they all got away? Mendez asked.
The only raider we captured killed himself with variant acid before we could question him, Beckham said. Lincoln reared back.
Those people are worse than the monsters, Mendez said, brows crunched together. That's because they're working with the monsters, aren't they? Rico asked. That's the only explanation that makes sense to me.
I think you're right, Beckham said. They seem to be connected somehow, and that's why I'm here, to find out and plan an offensive before they strike again.
Fitz got the sense that wasn't the only reason Beckham was here. It was an open secret that Ringgold had been recruiting him to run for office, and with McComb's demise, he suspected the meeting with Ringgold wasn't just a coincidence. But Fitz saved his questions for later. There would be plenty of time to catch up in private.
You hungry? Rico asked.
Beckham shook his head. But I'll sit with you guys. He sat across from Dohai. How are you feeling, brother? Dohai shrugged.
I'll live.
Not gonna lie, I thought you were variant chowder, Ace said with a chuckle.
His upper cheeks above his long white beard turned red when none of the other members found his statement amusing.
Anyone ever tell you that you look like Santa Claus with those rosy cheeks? Lincoln said.
Ace shrugged.
A skinnier version, yeah.
Fitz frowned. The big guy really needed to learn when to joke and when to keep his mouth shut. So did Lincoln, for that matter. Picking up a fork, Fitz went back to eating his roast beef and mashed potatoes.
On the flight here, I read your report on those tunnels, Beckham said. Most men never would have made it out alive.
Those people down there. I hope they didn't survive, because if they did, let's just say hell couldn't be any worse, Dohai said.
Beckham leaned forward. We've all seen some pretty horrifying stuff, and before this war is over, we're going to see more. As painful as it is to talk about, that's why we need to figure out what these tunnels are and more about the Alpha you killed.
I just hope it's not too late, Fitz thought.
Officer on deck, came a bellowing voice. The sailors and soldiers all stood as General Souza and an entourage walked into the mess hall, boots clicking on the deck.
Briefing room in 15 minutes, said Lieutenant Brian Festa, the liaison officer, LNO, from SOCOM.
Fitz grabbed his tray and followed the rest of the enlisted troops and sailors out of the mess in a hurry. By the time they got to the briefing room, the place was packed. Fitz and Beckham went to the front to stand at a table with General Souza and President Ringgold. Secret Service agents flanked them, along with a middle-aged man in a lab coat that Fitz had never seen before. While more people filed into the room, the president shook hands with Beckham. They turned away from the crowd, speaking somewhat quietly within their group. Fitz was close enough to catch some of the conversation, something about Senator McComb and attending one of her speeches before he made up his mind. When Beckham turned around, Fitz could tell by the look on his face he wasn't happy. Fitz's suspicions about the Senate race seemed to be right.
All right, people, let's get started, General Souza said.
He swept a commanding gaze over the men and women in front of him.
We've got a hell of a situation on our hands, so I'm going to cut right to the chase. Three outposts have gone dark from variant attacks, and three more were attacked by raiders.
He motioned to Lieutenant Festa. The shorter man with puffy thin hair stepped over to a wall-mounted monitor. A map of the country came online. He tapped the touchscreen and pulled up a 5-state area.
Outpost Turkey River, Iowa.
Outpost Rapid City, South Dakota, and Outpost Kansas City, Missouri, have all gone dark, Festa said. Our recon teams discovered the variants used tunnels to avoid our defenses.
Hushed voices broke out in the room.
Quiet, Sousa said.
Festa waited a moment and then continued.
Three more outposts were attacked by raiders, but they were all on the East Coast. Needless to say, we believe these attacks are all connected.
Sousa picked up when Festa paused.
The pattern of these attacks suggests there is some sort of connected network here in the Midwest. We still don't know how the variants are communicating over such large areas or with the human collaborators.
Festa touched the monitor again, this time bringing up a map of the northeastern seaboard.
The raider attacks hit outposts in the following areas, Festa said. Portland, Maine. New Boston, Massachusetts. Providence, Rhode Island. Casualties are still coming in, but we're already in the hundreds.
More voices broke out around the room. The numbers were chilling. After years of only the stray variant attacks and random raiders, the news was beyond devastating to the men and women that had fought for peace, especially President Ringgold. She stood at the front of the room, stiff and proud, but the pallor that had overcome her face belied her confident posture. She was clearly horrified at what was happening in the final months of her administration. Her entire legacy was at stake, not to mention the future of the country.
We expect casualties to continue rising, and we're also preparing for more attacks, Sousa said.
Fitz studied the map on the wall-mounted screen, trying to come up with a theory of what was happening. Unless the variants had evolved to use radios and their transmissions were somehow encrypted, he had no freaking idea how they could be coordinating over such a large territory.
We now believe many of the variant kidnappings over the past few years weren't for food, Sousa continued. Personally, I believe these kidnappings were to create a small army of raiders that were utilized the other night to inflict terror.
Fitz wasn't surprised. He had met a few collaborators in his day. Most were batshit crazy after being held hostage by the monsters. The general paused and looked over at the man in the lab coat.
This is Dr. Jeff Carr. He will be working with Dr. Kate Lovato to figure out exactly what we're dealing with, starting with the Alpha variant from Outpost Turkey River and the other samples our teams have retrieved.
Thank you, General. Carr stepped up to the monitor and brought up an image of the beast that the Navy had stored in a freezer a deck below their feet. Fitz had already seen it up close and personal, but seeing it on screen still sent a chill up his spine.
This is an Alpha that no one has seen before now, Carr said. Based off our field reports and my research, it seems to use echolocation to find prey. We also believe that the fibers attached to its spine may have something to do with the strange webbing found in the tunnels our recon teams found. We're not quite sure what the purpose of those fibers are. If you should meet one in the wild, any observations are appreciated. Other than that, all I can say is that you should expect the unexpected with these new monsters.
President Ringgold stepped up.
I was hoping the worst days of humanity were behind us, she said. But again, we are faced with another threat to our species.
Fitz felt a sense of deja vu and could almost guess what was coming next.
I've decided to send in recon teams for more intel before we mount an offensive or reach out to our allies for help, Ringgold continued. General Sousa is in the process of putting together teams, and I've authorized the deployment of our main fighting force to be evenly distributed to the 98 outposts to help guard them from future attacks.
Fitz appreciated her proactive approach, but wondered if she knew something he didn't. Deploy all of the troops?
Operation Shadow will start in a few hours, Ringgold said.
She swept her gaze over the hardened soldiers, sailors, and Marines.
Make no mistake, ladies and gentlemen, this new threat may be the greatest we have faced since the first days of the hemorrhage virus, Ringgold said. It will be up to you to help stop it before we lose everything we have fought to rebuild.
Fitz and Beckham exchanged a glance as two old friends and warriors. Both of them knew exactly what this meant. No rest for Team Ghost. They were headed back into the fray. Dohai knelt in the knee-high grass. The blades were already golden, dried by the onslaught of cooler weather striking Outpost Duluth in Minnesota. Between the crushed stalks of grass were the unmistakable taloned footprints of the variants. Just like General Sousa had feared, the variants had continued their assaults, reaching all the way into northern Minnesota. This was just the latest attack,
occurring only hours after their briefing on the USS George Johnson. Team Ghost stood in the overgrown practice baseball and softball fields at the University of Minnesota Duluth. The campus had been retrofitted over the years into a fortified outpost, complete with chain-link fences, razor wire, and all the electronic surveillance equipment the military had given them. Unlike Outpost Turkey River and Outpost Rapid City, the defenses had held, and only a handful of monsters had managed to get inside before they were repelled and forced to retreat. The emergency alert system the Ringgold administration had provided to all of the outposts had helped too, and this one knew trouble was coming from the quick-acting alert. But Dohai had a feeling it was really the two platoons of Army Rangers working with the militia that had saved this place from falling. A group of Rangers were helping treat civilians across the field, some of which had lost loved ones in the fighting. The sobs and cries of pain drifted in the blustering winds. White sheets covered the bodies of the deceased in neat rows. Dohai and Team Ghost made their way across the field.
"Who's in charge here?" Fitz called out.
An Asian man with broad shoulders looked over his shoulder and then walked over to Fitz.
"That would be me," he held out a hand to Fitz. "Sergeant Randall Chung with the 3rd Battalion.
Master Sergeant Fitzpatrick with Team Ghost."
Fitz gestured at the other men, and Dohai nodded.
"Glad to have you with us, Master Sergeant," Chung said.
He sighed and gestured to the bodies.
"We did what we could, but we couldn't stop all of the variants once they tunneled in."
"Wish we'd gotten here sooner," Mendez said.
Chung adjusted his chin strap.
"You guys have any idea on where all these beasts are coming from?"
"That's what we're here to find out," Fitz said.
Dohai walked over to a hole near home plate while Fitz and Chung spoke. He flicked on his tactical light and shone it down into a passage covered in the glistening red webbing. The nightmares of what he had seen in those tunnels at Turkey River flashed through his mind. He felt a pang of nausea as images of the half-buried people with tendrils growing from their mouths and out of their orbital cavities passed through his mind.
"You okay, bro?"
Dohai looked back at Mendez, who stood with his rifle cradled. They rejoined the rest of the team at the tail end of the conversation.
"Did the variants escape with any people?" Fitz asked.
"None that we know of, but we haven't accounted for all civilians yet," Chung said.
"Did you see any alphas?" Fitz asked.
"Caught one."
Chung pointed toward the opposite side of the field where the Rangers had dumped the remains of the beasts. The team made their way over to corpses riddled with bullet holes, their gray flesh even paler in death. Unseeing reptilian eyes staring up at the cloud-covered sky. Dohai checked the barrel chest of an Alpha. It was the same type that he had fought at Outpost Turkey River.
"Have your men started searching the tunnels yet?" Fitz asked.
"No," Chung replied. "We've been too busy cleaning up this mess. But we've got an R2TD set up and ready to go to look for others."
Chung motioned to one of the red brick-covered buildings.
"Thomas, Watson, get the R2TD over here," he called.
Two of the Rangers began setting up the equipment.
"You all used one of these before?" Chung asked.
"I got some experience," Ace said.
"And be our guest. It'll be more effective to have you guys on this one than us. I want to make sure we're prepared for another attack."
Ace jogged over to the two Rangers. They strapped the pack over his back and handed him the tube-shaped radar device.
"If we're going to prevent this from happening again, then we need to find out where these tunnels are coming from," Fitz said. "That's the only way we can launch an effective offensive."
"Whatever it takes," Rico said.
"Man, we're going underground," Lincoln mumbled.
"You ever stop complaining?"
Mendez gave Lincoln a questioning glare.
"I mean, not really,"
Lincoln smirked. A cold wind howled over the open field, a harbinger of the winter that was only weeks away, silencing the team. Dohai thought he heard something else on the wind, like the distant moan of someone in pain. Maybe it was just his mind playing tricks on him. Those images of his time in the tunnels flashed through his thoughts again. He did not want to go back underground again either, but if Fitz gave the order, he would do whatever it took, just like Rico had said.
"Good luck," Chung called out.
Fitz led the team toward the edge of the university campus. Chain-link fences and razor wire marked the border. Two of the town's militia soldiers pulled back a mechanized gate to let Team Ghost through.
Ace studied the scream of the R2TD as they marched south, following the curve of Lake Superior into the city of Duluth. Houses lined the streets around them. Most seemed to have been vacant for years. Broken glass stuck up in shards around rotted window frames. Some were burned down to their foundations, now nothing more than piles of charcoal debris. Ace led them between the lawns of abandoned structures until they reached a wide park with tall trees. Canopies of leaves, the shades of fire, rustled in the wind.
"Tunnels end here," Ace said, looking up from his screen, perplexed.
"Not quite," Dohai said.
He bent next to a hole in the ground about as big as his waist. Several braided ropes of red tissue protruded from the edge and stretched across a creek. Taking off a glove, he then traced his fingers over the rope of red webbing. Electricity practically flowed to his hand. The individual threads within the organic cables pulsed slightly, pushing back against his skin.
"They didn't dig under the water," Dohai said. "Maybe they were smart enough to know they'd risk collapsing the tunnel."
"That webbing," Mendez started.
"Keep following it," Fitz said.
Dohai lifted his rifle to his shoulder again. He pushed into water that rose up to the middle of his shins. The bank on the other side of the creek crested slightly. He scurried over the mud, still following the red tendrils. There they led back into another opening. Talon prints marred the ground between the carpet of dead leaves, but something else made his heart climb into his throat. He aimed his rifle into the darkness of the tunnel opening. Wind howled out of the variant-made cavern. Somewhere in there he thought he heard a groan.
"Get a hold of yourself, Dohai."
The groaning continued, and now he was almost certain this wasn't the wind.
God, he might be going mad.
He wondered if what he'd seen in those tunnels was coming back to haunt him in a bad way. He hated to admit it, but maybe he should have sat this mission out. If he didn't get his head on, he would become a liability to the other members. But he also didn't want to let them down. Fitz held up a fist. He pointed to his ear, then at the tunnel. Ace lowered the R2TD device. So maybe Dohai wasn't so crazy after all. The others had also heard the noise. And if someone was groaning in there, that meant they were still alive. Fitz signaled for them to turn on their lights. Then, with another gesture, he sent Dohai forward. He moved inside without hesitation, his light illuminating braided red cables that spread into the webbing. Claw marks marred the walls, and a trail of talon footprints led deeper. The pained, animalistic groans grew louder as they advanced. The closer he got, the more inhuman it sounded. Dohai crept along, following the curve in the tunnel, heart pounding harder with each step. He rounded the corner and swept the passage with his light. The shadows fled as the beam hit webbing that had grown together in a mass of strange flesh.
"What in the..." Dohai paused.
Red ropes climbed out of this creature's ears and open mouth. It wasn't human. Not variant, either. Dohai moved closer, shining his light to see it was a deer. More of the red webbing grew from open wounds. The chest slowly rose and fell, blood-covered fur glistening in the light. Every time it exhaled, it let out a haunted groan. The variants did not discriminate when it came to live prey, and it seemed that their wide taste in food extended to their use of living creatures for whatever this was. As the rest of Team Ghost filtered in around Dohai, their lights filled the tunnel. Other animals hung from the walls. Webbing grew from all of them. Some of the creatures were nothing but skin and bones, their fur falling away in large clumps. Dohai said a prayer for every animal that the variants had done this to as he moved deeper. Heat swelled in his chest. This was an abomination of nature. He had read Kate's report on the flight and understood that such fast-spreading growths needed sustenance. The variants seemed to be turning humans and animals into fuel. Team Ghost pushed along through the darkness. Fitz pulled out his knife and ended the suffering of the deer and other living animals behind them. Dohai flinched at each sound and walked faster at the sight of columns of light in the distance. A way out of this hell. Dohai followed the light to a ramp of scree that led into the sunlight. This was the end of the tunnel. He made his way up on the side of a hill overlooking Lake Superior.
The vast freshwater body stretched all the way to Michigan. The rest of Team Ghost joined him, fanning out to follow the variant footprints that scattered in all directions. Whoever, or whatever, was organizing these monsters knew what they were doing. There was no easy path forward. Except. Dohai dropped to a knee. A slight glint caught his eye. A flash of scarlet peeking out from the black soil near his boots. He hooked a finger on the red tendril and pulled it up. More of the red webbing unearthed itself as he pulled on the organic cables. The more fibers that Dohai pulled up, the more certain he was that these tendrils would lead them to something. But when Fitz signaled for Ace to use the R2TD system again, they found no more tunnel systems. It seemed that while the fibers continued on, the tunnels were only dug when the beasts were close to the outpost.
"Might want to tell command what we're finding," Dohai said. "If I had to guess, the variants don't just tunnel all the way from one part of the country to another."
"No shit," Lincoln said. "That would be impossible." Rico reached out toward the webbing Dohai had in his gloves. "This reminds me of something I saw on the National Geographic Channel once," she said. "The world's largest living organism, at least at that time, was a mushroom. It covered like 2,000 acres of forest in Oregon. Most of it all just tiny filaments underground." Lincoln bent down to pull up another strand.
"Don't look like mushrooms to me."
"You missed the point," Rico said.
"Come on, guys, keep digging this shit up so we can see where it leads," Fitz ordered.
The team worked for an hour to peel the fibers up, taking them south and deeper into the woods. Finally, as the light of day began to wane, Fitz called off the search.
"Let's get back to the outpost," Fitz said. "We'll pick this trail up at first light."
While they walked, Dohai looked southward, past the tree-covered horizon, wondering where those webbings would lead.
"Seems like the variants can collapse those tunnels at will," he said.
"Makes sense to me," Rico said. "If those things are like muscle fibers or whatever Kate said, then maybe they can force the tunnels to contract.
They dig the tunnels just far enough away so they can attack unseen, then poof," Mendez said. "They yank the tunnels closed after they exit back out the other end."
"And still leave the fibers behind in this massive network," Dohai said.
"Hold up a second."
He pulled out a map from his pack, studying it in the waning light.
"The tunnels, or at least the webbings, head this way," Dohai said, tracing the direction they had followed over the map. "And the ones from Turkey River."
Fitz's eyes widened, seeming to understand where he was going with this.
"From New Chicago, reports said the tunnels were headed northwest, and from Kansas City almost straight north."
"Well, shit," Mendez said. "I failed geography, but even I know where that leads. It's gotta be New York." Dohai laughed. A rare act.
"Not even close, man."
"I know I was kidding," Mendez chuckled.
"Only you weren't, dumbass."
Lincoln looked over Dohai's shoulder, glancing at the map. Dohai shook his head.
"You guys never stop, do you?"
"So what are you thinking?" Fitz asked.
"I'm thinking if you triangulate all of these tunnels, we know where this web might have originated from," Dohai said.
He jabbed a finger at the map. Right over Minneapolis.
"All the networks we've discovered head that direction, and if these fibers need a lot of people to grow, there is probably more than enough food for them there."
"The Midwest outposts are rife with people," Rico added. "Highest number of kidnappings before all this started, too."
"God damn, you guys are smart," Mendez said.
"I guess we know where we're going next," Lincoln grumbled.
"Back underground, huh?"
Dohai had a feeling he was right.
14.
Kate soaked in the astringent smells of the laboratory on Peaks Island. The stinging odor of the freshly sanitized, whitewashed tiled floors and black lab benches never failed to energize her. Fluorescent lights buzzed on with the flip of switches. The lab itself wasn't exactly cavernous, but working alone in here made the place feel like she was the last person left on Earth. She had barely seen Beckham before he'd been sent off to SOCOM, and her time with Javier felt like little more than an exchange of a few words before bedtime over the past 48 hours. As much as she knew she should rest and spend time with her son, her country needed her again.
No one else in the world had her experience and expertise researching variants. Fortunately, she was getting the help she needed. Today she was receiving support staff and the body of an alpha that Team Ghost had retrieved from Outpost Turkey River. She worked fast to get the lab in tip-top shape for the new arrivals. When she finished, she checked on the cell culture experiments with the samples from the webbing. Once again, they had grown to the limits of the large plastic flasks she had placed them in. It seemed they grew out of each smaller cell culture plate and flask in a matter of minutes. The only limitation on their growth was the amount of nutrient media she placed in the containers. She turned at the intercom's buzzer. Sergeant Ruckley stood behind the glass wall near the intercom system. "Dr. Lovato, the new staff just landed and will be here shortly," she said. Kate gave a thumbs-up sign and went right back to work. One by one, she checked her smaller samples before moving on to the riskiest experiment she had set up. No laboratory she knew made much use of cell flasks larger than a liter or two. Even that was on the big end of things. When she saw the webbing would outgrow its container so quickly, she had put in a strange request with her suppliers that had thankfully been answered. She needed a 50-gallon fish tank. The tank now housed a monstrous cell growth at the back of the lab behind a plexiglass window. Strangely, the cells no longer looked like the well-organized red webs, but rather lab-grown meat. She walked over to check the mass of red cells. They seemed to throb and pulsate within the equipment. For the next 30 minutes, she examined the growth, wondering if she should move it into a bigger enclosure. If they got any bigger, the tank would fracture. A sudden knock against the lab's door caused her to jump. This time, Beckham stood behind the glass.
"What in the hell is that?" he said, staring at the fish tank.
"That's what I'm trying to find out," she said loud enough for him to hear her through the window. She peeled off the nitrile gloves she wore, tossing them into the trash. Then she removed her lab coat and joined Beckham outside the lab.
"How are you?" Beckham said, tugging on her hand.
"Tired. You?"
"We have a lot of work to do."
Kate had a feeling that could mean a number of things, but she didn't ask. She simply wrapped him in a hug. "You know that doesn't exactly answer my question," she said.
"I'll be fine."
The click of footsteps pulled her away. Horn stood next to a tall man with dark, slicked-back hair. The newcomer approached with an extended hand. "I'm Dr. Jeff Carr," he said. Kate took his hand. "Dr. Kate Lovato."
"A pleasure to meet you," Carr said. "The president has spoken very highly of your work. Your reputation certainly precedes you in what's left of the scientific community," he finished with an awkward grin.
Kate had stopped worrying about her reputation years ago. It was evenly split between hate and love after her scientific developments killed billions of those initially infected by the hemorrhage virus, only to create the deadlier variants.
"Welcome to my humble lab," Kate said. "I'm happy to have you here to assist with the work."
"Assist?" Carr's eyebrows rose as if he was dismayed. "I thought this would be more of an egalitarian, team-based approach."
"Oh, of course," Kate said, suddenly looking a little uncomfortable.
Carr peered back down the hall and waved at the cadre of people surrounding a cart there.